Okay, so we're live here from Grover Beach. This is our second broadcast over the internet. And today I will be talking about what it means to be a Buddhist. Because being a Buddhist is not the most important thing for us to think about. Some people often, I'm often asked, what does it mean to be a Buddhist, and how does one become a Buddhist, and or how does one know one is a Buddhist, or so on? What is the definition of a Buddhist? And the standard way of answering this question is that a Buddhist is someone who accepts basically two things. One is the Buddha, his teachings, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha as one's refuge. Number one, and number two, one accepts the five precepts as basic morality, which one intends to follow. So, for as long as one is keeping to these two things, one could be considered a Buddhist, and is generally considered a Buddhist in a traditional sense. So to explain what today, I'd like to just explain what it means to take these things as refuge, and what is meant by the five precepts. So for some people, this might be already old news, but perhaps there's some new information that can be got from it. So this is the talk that I'd like to give today. The three refuges is summarized by the formula Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, Dhammang Saranang Gacchami, Sanghang Saranang Gacchami. And it's something that is recited usually in front of a monk by traditional Buddhists in traditional Buddhist societies. It's something that people may often recite on their own, either on a daily or a weekly basis. We incorporate it into our chanting in the morning and chanting in the evening. So if we're doing regular chanting, then we would incorporate this into our daily routine. The translation of the passage, Buddhang is the Buddha, Saranang Gacchami means I go, as in traveling, but here it means one sends one's mind out to the Buddha. And then Saranang. The word Saranang is the difficult one, because we always translate it as refuge, because you're going somewhere, right? You're going, so it's taking the Buddha as sort of a location. But the truth is, the word Sarana, if we're going to translate it literally, probably the best translation is as a object of reflection. That we take the Buddha as an object of recollection. And so we have this actual meditation that is called Buddhanusati. And the word sati is related to the word sarana. Sara is the root of the verb for both the word sati, which we always translate as mindfulness, and for sarana, which we translate as refuge. But the real meaning is of sar is to remember. So it's remembering about the Buddha, or recalling the Buddha, bringing the Buddha to mind. And the idea here is a lot like the Christian concept, where they ask themselves, what would Jesus do? So it's a thinking about Jesus before they act, or so on, thinking about his teachings. And so they look over the brief period of time that Jesus was teaching, and they try to use that as a way of answering life's problems. So in Buddhism, we do the same thing. As Buddhists, we'll take the Buddha as our point of reference for anything that we do. If we're going to do something, we have to look at the Buddha first and see if it's something that he would approve of. See if it's something that he would consider to be a good thing. This is what it means to be a Buddhist. It's not like we're trying to convert people, but people ask, What does it mean to be a Buddhist? Well, if you want to consider yourself a Buddhist, here's what it takes. In the start, you have to, if you want to call yourself a Buddhist, you have to at least, if you want to say you're a follower of the Buddha, one who takes the Buddha as your refuge, then you have to, at the very least, take the Buddha into consideration when you do or say or think things. And the great thing about the Buddha is that he was around for 45 years. So apart from what he taught, and of course the 45 years gave him an incredible amount of time to really establish his teachings, it also gave us a good picture, which has been handed down, of who he was. No, really, there's nothing mysterious about the Buddha because he was always the same for the 45 years. You were able to document the sort of characteristics that one would find in such a being. And so we have this easy point of reference to let ourselves know what is the ideal human being or the ideal which we're hoping to strive towards or we're hoping to emulate, hoping to follow after. And the great benefit of this, well, it should be obvious. The obvious benefit is that we have then a role model to guide our way of thinking. But there's another benefit which is not so obvious, I suppose, for people who are not Buddhist or people who are not traditionally Buddhist, is that it makes you like it would in Christianity. It makes you happy. It makes you peaceful. So we're not. It's not only an intellectual exercise where we're going to think to ourselves, "Would the Buddha do that? Would the Buddha not do that?" But just thinking about the Buddha is like thinking about any great religious or spiritual leader who may be seen by the devotee as pure. Well, we understand that the Buddha was quite pure, and when we read about him and learn about him and hear about who he was and what he did and how all of his various virtues, we understand that he was fully enlightened. He was the Vijja Charana Sampanno. He was one who was endowed with both knowledge and conduct. So he practiced what he preached, and we learn about the things that he taught and the ways that he practiced. Lokavidu, he was one who knew and understood this world. He understood all of the ways of the universe, or the nature of the universe. He understood how it was all laid out. He was able to see things that most people could not see. And he was able to train people. This is the chanting that we do every night. We say Anuttaro Purisa Dhammasarathi. Means he was like a charioteer, like someone who leads horses on the right path. So he's someone who is able to train people who are willing to be trained or able to be trained. He's able to tame the defilements that exist in people's minds through his teaching. Satta Deva Manusanang. He was the teacher of both angels and humans, kings and princes, all kinds of beings, all kinds of humans and non-humans. He was able to reach out to, and it's not just a matter of faith that we believe this. We can actually see his teachings, and regardless of who it was that taught these things, we can see how profound this was. And so taking this person, whoever he was, who taught these things, as our role model is just an incredibly peaceful thing to do. Why I say this is important is because our ultimate goal is to sit down and practice meditation and see reality for ourselves. And one of the most useful things as a preliminary step is to calm the mind, to change the way the mind works so that the mind doesn't run here and run there, to kind of tie the mind down as sort of a preliminary step. Because if our mind is running around, it can be very difficult to practice meditation. Even though it's technically possible, it's quite difficult for the average ordinary ordinary person. So we have this technique of thinking about the Buddha. And so this is what it means to take the Buddha as our sarana, as our refuge. That's misleading to say refuge so much. Misleading, it's a misleading translation. It's nice to think of the Buddha as a refuge, like he's going to somehow save us. But I imagine it could probably lead to great misunderstanding. I've heard of people asking, what's the difference between Buddha and God? What's the difference between Buddha and Jesus? And so on. And, well, I mean, it's a really absurd question about God. It's obvious that the Buddha was nothing like what we understand to be God, or what most people would, most theists believe to be God. It's a totally different thing. But the misunderstanding comes from this idea that we're somehow taking the Buddha as our savior. And the Buddha was not a savior. The Buddha said, I show the way. A Buddha is someone who shows the way. It's up to you to walk the path. So we're taking him as our role model and as our guiding light, if you will. He's someone who guides us and leads us on the right path. And he's able to do that because we have all of his teachings, 45 years. We have a huge accumulated amount of body of teachings, which is readily available even to this day. You can find pieces of it on the internet in the Tipitaka. And access to insight.org has some good resources, and buddhanet.net and so on. So this is what it means to take the Buddha as our sarana. Taking the Dhamma as our sarana is a little bit more to the point, and it's a little bit more how the Buddha would have it. Really, the Buddha wasn't, most of the time, wasn't so keen on having people look at him and look to him. It was always look to the Dhamma, try and see the Dhamma. There was even a man who spent all of his time following the Buddha around because he loved the way the Buddha looked, and he loved the sound of the Buddha's voice and so on. And so he found himself not practicing meditation, just wandering after the Buddha all the time. And wherever the Buddha went, he would follow after and just sit there and waste his time. So the Buddha realized that if he didn't do something, this guy would, you know, get stuck at this state of happiness and peace. And as I said, this is a great benefit of looking at the Buddha, watching the Buddha, thinking about the Buddha, that you feel really peaceful and happy. But as I said, it's just preliminary. And if you get stuck there, or it's stuck in any way, it's not just with the Buddha. If you get stuck on your states of peace and calm in any sort of meditative practice, it can be really really easy to get stuck and very difficult to continue on without someone to jolt you out of it. And so in this case, this is what the Buddha did. He jolted the man out of it. He said, get out of here. Why are you looking at this ugly, stinky, filthy, rotting corpse of a body? He said, don't you know, whoever sees the Dhamma, which is the reality or the teachings, the things that I have taught, that is someone who sees me. One who sees me is only those people who see the Dhamma. And so he said, apehi, get out of here. And this man went on his way and was ready to kill himself, actually. It was so devastating to him to have the Buddha scold him in this way that he was ready to throw himself off a cliff. And then the Buddha came and he was mollified. But then he was mollified and he realized how changing one's emotions can be. And this was a way of opening his eyes to the fact that even these great states of happiness are impermanent. Even great states of suffering are impermanent. So instead of killing himself, he practiced meditation, or he realized, he started watching these emotions and letting go of them, and became bored and became disenchanted by them, and was able to let go of his attachment and be able to become free from suffering as a result. So with this with other stories, we can see that the most important thing for the Buddha was his teachings, was the Dhamma, that There's no place for Buddhism in blind worship or simple adorance or obedience or so on. There's the importance is in taking the Dhamma as our refuge or as our guiding light. That not only do we okay, taking the Buddha as our guiding light in terms of who he was and the great qualities that he had is great, and it can be useful as a role model. But what's even better is the teachings that he gave, because to just look at someone and take their example is often quite powerful. But on a deeper level, you have to then transform and ask yourself, how did they get to the way that they are? And often that's through many different steps, and often their steps will not be the same as your steps. And there might have to be, you might have to go through some things that they didn't have to, or so on. And so the teachings of the Buddha become incredibly important for us to not only emulate, but to follow the path that the Buddha has followed already. And so the Buddha gave various teachings on various topics. 45 years we have volume after volume of these teachings, and categorized and separated out into groups and sizes and so on. And so our asservation as Buddhists is that we take this body of texts, this body of teachings, as our refuge. We don't go elsewhere looking for the truth in other places. Or if we come across a teaching in another tradition and it is contrary to what the Buddha taught, then the defining character of a Buddhist is that they come to the understanding or the decision or the realization that the teaching of the Buddha is the proper interpretation, and that which is outside of the Buddha's teaching is not proper. If someone were to come to the interpretation that that which is outside of the Buddha's teaching is proper and that which the Buddha taught is not proper, then unless one could somehow prove that this is not what the Buddha taught, one would have to say that one is not Buddhist or is not committed to being Buddhist. And again, this is not a judgment call. This is only a definition. So we're asking, what is the definition of a Buddhist? A real Buddhist is someone who has come to the decision on their own, without any bullying or persuasion, that the Buddha's interpretation of reality is the most correct. And anything that disagrees with it does so because it's not correct. And the third object of recollection or object of reference is the Sangha. And the Sangha is a little bit more down to earth than using the Buddha as our object of reference, because the Buddha is this perfect ideal state which we can strive for but often seems unattainable. What we have instead is we have this community of followers of the Buddha who, though one could say they were perfect, they have their idiosyncrasies, and we have their stories of how they, even went through things that the Buddha didn't have to go through because of his greatness. Even when he was not yet a Buddha, his superiority as a being just made it really easy for him to become enlightened. But here we have these stories of people who really had it tough, people who may have had incredible defilements and were able to just throw them off. People who were thieves, people who were drunks, people who were prostitutes. There were all sorts. There were kings. There were all sorts of people who then became what we call the Sangha. So we say Sanghang Saranangacchami. I take the Sangha as my sarana, as my object of refuge or recollection or reference or so on, as my guiding light. And we have characteristics of the Sangha as well, which allows us to understand who it is that we take as our role model, or who it is that we hope to strive to be like. Besides just the Buddha, trying to be more and more like this group of people who, number one, have practiced upright Ujju, means they have practiced well or in an upright manner, means they are people who don't do things out of greed, out of anger, or don't do crooked things. Sorry, Suppatipanno is the first one, is well practiced, means they don't do bad things. Ujjupatipanno means they don't do crooked things, they practice straightforwardly. Yayapatipanno means they go according to the Buddha's way. So we follow after people who have followed the Buddha's way, who go according to the method that the Buddha gave. And Sammijipatipanno, they go appropriately, they practice appropriately. And people who practice the middle way, not pushing themselves too hard and not being lazy or indulgent. So taking these three things as the object of our recollection, or as our object of homage, you could say, I hesitate to say the word worship, because even though one could get to the point where one really adores these things, to the point where it looks a lot like worship, it's never to the point of godhood, where one deifies these things. One only pays homage as one would to a perfect person. No, the way we look to perhaps movie stars or famous people or so on. Something like that, only it can get to a very religious level, and the states of mind are actually quite similar and can actually be quite powerful. It can be a lot like worship in a deist faith or religion, where we adore and worship these things for the great feeling that it brings, this the feeling of peace and rapture and so on, which I said can be a very useful and on a preliminary basis, and can be really nice for people. It brings people together, it gives them a sense of community, it gives them something to look forward to at the end of a hard day and so on. It makes people happy. It's like an opiate. This is the quote that religion is the opiate of the masses. But it's not so bad to have something that makes you happy and peaceful, and if it's the Buddha, then it's really not a negative thing. It's not something that's going to lead you to go out and do bad things and say bad things. And this is what it means to be a Buddhist, is to take these three things. And the great thing about it is this is what's going to lead us onward and upward, because taking the Buddha as our refuge gives us a leader, someone who we can use as a decision-making when we're going to do or say or think something, or follow after this or that teaching. We base it on the Buddha. And then we have his body of teachings. We have all these things he said not to do, and then we have all these things that he said we should do. And so we have this huge body of teaching to sort of guide us. I think the greatest thing about the Dhamma is that the more we practice, the more sense it makes. The more we sit down and look at reality, the more we actually want to study and look at these teachings and come to understand them. The more keen we are to look at them, it's like it just gets more and more appetizing the more we partake. And we take the Sangha as our refuge. So this is a way of saying who our friends are, even people who are living, who we understand to be following the teaching of the Buddha. So we take those people as our friends, and we're very careful with choosing our friends wisely, and those people who are practicing moral, noble lives according to the Buddha and according to our understanding as in our practice. This is the first part of what it means to be Buddhist, is to take these three things as our refuge. The second aspect of what it means to be a Buddha is the taking of the five precepts. And so This one is probably a little bit less understood or less heard about. And so, a lot of people, if you're not interested in Theravada Buddhism, the Buddhism, classical Buddhism of Thailand, Burma, Cambodia, Laos, and Sri Lanka, then you may not have heard of these five precepts. And some people, even as Buddhists, will shy away from these things. So I think it's up to different people's interpretation of Buddhism, but for those people who follow after the Buddha as opposed to taking Buddhism to mean something maybe perhaps a little bit different, these five precepts are considered to be the essential morality. And everything that whatever we wish to do in our life has to go through the filter of these five precepts. We don't do or say anything which would go against these. And so, what are these five precepts? The first one is that we don't kill. Second is that we don't steal. The third is that we don't tell lies. The third is that we don't commit adultery or cheat on our partner, I guess adultery is the best interpretation. The fourth is that we don't lie. And the fifth is that we don't take intoxicants like drugs, alcohol, and so on. These five are the basic, something like the Ten Commandments that we hear about in Christianity or Judaism. And there's only five of them. This is the first thing that's worth saying. So many people are grumbling about these and saying, even these are not necessary all of the time. It's worth noticing that, if it's really that difficult or that trying or hard to keep these five precepts, then probably you're not ready for the more difficult practice of meditation or direct contemplation of reality. So sometimes people bicker and argue over whether these things are really necessary. I think it's really kind of sad, I suppose, that just five rules we can't keep, and we have more than these when we go to practice sports, or when we're in school, or when we're at work, in a karate dojo or kung fu. In any of the martial arts traditions, there are at least this many, if there are more rules than this, or codes of behavior and so on. And so simply keeping five rules when we come to undertake the practice of the Buddha's teaching really shouldn't be that trying, or that much of a, there shouldn't be really that much argument. Now, the argument that people often have is that these things are not necessarily bad. For instance, killing can be helpful, they say, in some cases. And we have to remember the context of these rules is not a god or a divine being giving these things. It's not the Buddha saying, follow my rules or else. It's the Buddha saying that you want to practice meditation, then you're going to need some rules to live by to keep your mind free from defilement. And that's the key here, is that these things are considered to be harmful to the mind. If you've never really killed anything significant, it's hard to see this. I for myself know it. When I was young, I was hunting with my father, and the first time I ever killed a large animal, I think I only ever succeeded once. It was really difficult to do. It was something that made my whole body shake, which was strange because, killing insects when I was young was not a big deal. But when it came to killing something significant, it really shocked me at the time. And at the time, I had no clue about what was right or wrong, or any interest in right or wrong. I was really pretty out of it. But suddenly, having no interest or care, no worry or doubt about what I was doing, suddenly it My body started shaking, and it was really difficult to pull the trigger. On subsequent occasions, when I tried to hunt and it was unsuccessful, it was really difficult, really easy to pull the trigger. It was much easier than the first time, which surprised me later on. And when I started practicing, Buddhism was an object of curiosity for me, why it should be that way. And the answer, of course, is that these things, we don't realize how much of an impact they have on our lives. How profound is our relationship to the universe around us? How this idea that I end at my fingertips is actually just a concept. That in reality, what we're talking about is a network of particles or subatomic particles, and even the mental mesh that is, connecting between us and all of the other beings in this world is a very profound thing and something that we don't realize and aren't able to see. We don't see that there's a connection between us and the object of our karma, the other beings around us. So by killing the deer on that day, it was an incredible disruption of this harmony which had existed between us before that. So it was like shaking the boat, and it was really, really sad. It was really, really one of those points in life that one has to regret for a long time. And so, to anyone who says that, there are times when killing is useful or so on, I think at the very least we should be a lot more careful when we say this, and we should weigh the fact that it's going to have a profound impact on our lives. If anyone ever has been in contact with people who have ever been in war and survived war, if they can't tell you themselves, you can see it in their ways of behavior that have changed since they've been in the war, for those people who have killed, for those people who have been on active duty and so on. And so we should be very careful before we dismiss these things. I mean, we're talking about someone who was superbly advanced in the practice of meditation and really had an understanding of the benefits and detriments of our various actions. And so it's not something that we should take lightly, that this was just off the top of the Buddha's head or something. After years and years, and you could say lifetimes and lifetimes of meditation practice, the Buddha came to these five rules. It's not something that he just thought up one day. And he said these five rules are the basis of morality for human beings. It's not even something he took to be his own teaching. He said this is natural morality. If you want to be considered a human being, you have to keep these five rules. It's the nature of humanity. So, just to describe in a little bit of detail these five rules, the first one is not to kill. It can also be extended to include not to harm. Some people ask, why are these five rules considered enough when rape isn't in there and torture isn't in there and so on? Well, the point is these five are the basic morality. It's not to say that everything that doesn't fall into these is moral, but these five are utterly reprehensible. They have a profound impact on one's mind. Other acts might have a lesser impact on one's mind, depending on their nature as well. And again, these are only just a guideline to give us some idea of the things which we should avoid in meditation. So obviously torturing and harming other beings without killing them can be equally or at least comparably harmful to our state of mind. They aren't specified by these five precepts. So what does it mean to kill something? It means to intentionally deprive something of its life, not just intending to do something that happens to deprive a being of its life. It means your intention is really to take the life away from a being, and you're successful. So it doesn't the precept isn't broken technically when you intend to but don't carry something out, or when you don't, especially when you don't intend to. and a being dies as a result of your actions, like stepping on ants, for instance, or driving a car and hitting a dog or a deer or so on. This isn't a karma, this isn't a bad deed, and one shouldn't feel bad about it. One should maybe feel bad that one was reckless and not careful, but should not consider that one is guilty of murder. This is the way of the world. It's clear that the vibrations or the mesh of the universe was leading that being in that direction. And your association with that being led them to that fate. It's not that we shouldn't feel upset thinking that we're guilty of murder in cases that we didn't intend to kill. And all of these really require intention. So stealing as well. Stealing means taking something that depriving someone of something without their permission. If someone doesn't give something away freely, when you deprive them of it, it's considered stealing. So copying things is not considered stealing. If you copy someone's idea, this is not, according to Buddhism, considered stealing. It's in fact, I would say, quite a benign act, according to Buddhism. And people who say that that's theft, they call intellectual property theft, are simply making it up on their own. And it's actually the argument on the other side is to say that it's sad that people hold these things which are generally useful for ransom, trying to make a living off of a good idea instead of trying to spread the wealth and give something away which doesn't deprive you of it. See, when I have a good idea and I give it away, or other people take it and use it themselves, I haven't been deprived of that idea. I can still use it for whatever I wish. I just have given it to allowed other people to reap the same benefit as myself. No less, no more. Adultery. Now, the translation that people generally give this is what is it? Sexual misconduct. And that leads to a lot of misunderstanding about the kinds of acts that could be considered sexual misconduct. And it's clear from the explanations of this precept that all is meant here is breaking up someone else's relationship or breaking up your own relationship. If you're in a relationship, then going out and finding someone else, or if someone else is in a relationship, going and trying to, or even succeeding in breaking up that relationship or compromising that relationship, compromising a romantic relationship through one's promiscuity. The fourth precept, not to lie. Again, first of all, it has to be intentional. You can't. Sometimes we say things without realizing that they're not true and catch ourselves afterwards. Once we catch ourselves, then if we repeat it or affirm it, then that's a lie. But if we've said something without realizing it, and then we catch ourselves and make effort, or at least don't make any more effort to affirm it, then we're not yet considered to have lied. But we should try, if possible or if reasonable, to make it clear that we didn't mean what we said. Why? Because otherwise, when they find out the truth, it could be quite problematic. I mean, these things have a repercussion on other people as well. When they find out that we've lied to them, it can be quite harmful and disruptive to our state of harmony. Another thing is, people often ask whether when someone asks you, "How are you?" and you say, "I'm fine," whether this is a lie if you're actually feeling like dirt or feeling awful. And I think there's some leeway here because, when you say, "I'm good" or "I'm fine," it could mean many different things. What you're trying to tell them is, what you're trying to express to the other person is not, trying to cover up the fact that you're upset. It's trying to say to them, "No, I don't need any help. Thank you very much. I don't need to burden you with my problems." So what they're asking for is there anything I can do to help you, or do you have problems that I can solve for you? When you say, "No, I'm fine," or I'm okay or so on. I think if you were to say, "Oh yeah, I'm really happy today," and you weren't happy at all, I suppose that would be a direct lie. But to say, "I'm fine, how are you?" Is basically to say, "I don't want to burden you with my problems." It's not the intention there is not to say, "Yeah, I haven't suffered at all. Today's been perfectly great for me. Today's been suffering free." That's not what is meant, and people understand this, that we all go through suffering. On another level, all they're saying is, "Hey, I hope everything is well with you," and all we're saying is, "Thank you." It's their expression of love for us, and it's our saying, "Thank you for asking." And kind of just putting their heart at ease. But you do have to be careful. You can't lie if someone says, "Are you sad today?" And you say, "No, I'm not sad," and actually you are sad. But simply to say we're fine or I'm okay or so on, I don't think that should be considered lying. I think we have to give some leeway here. Because of course the word fine and good can be interpreted in many ways, and it doesn't mean that you don't have any sadness or suffering. I know people who are pedantic about this and insist that when someone asks you if you're okay, you have to say, "Oh, sometimes good, sometimes bad." Otherwise, you're lying, and I don't think this is correct. Because then you're burdening the person with your problems, and they're going to have to ask and inquire and so on. And that's okay if you want to, but there may be times where it's not appropriate to burden other people with your problems. And the fifth rule is drugs and alcohol. This is usually the most difficult one for people, especially in the world today. Because we like to use drugs and alcohol as a coping mechanism or as a way to find happiness or pleasure. And we have to understand that, as I've explained before, drugs, even alcohol, they take our mind away from its state of sobriety. Remember, these are meditator precepts. These are rules for meditators. And though some people claim that you can have these wonderful meditative experiences on drugs or so on, I don't think anyone would claim it with alcohol, but what these things do is alter your perception. They don't give you a clear perception of your daily life. They change the chemicals in the brain, and if it's alcohol, then it's really dulling, it's poisoning the body, right? That's what alcohol does, and that's really has detriment on your ability to focus and your ability to, obviously, to see clearly. And so anyone who says that a couple of drinks or a glass of wine is not going to break the precept, I mean, all they're saying is that the amount is negligible. What one the argument would the response would be that negligible or not, it's like it's a drop in the cup. It's wrong. It's a step in the wrong direction. So if you take one step in the wrong direction, well, it doesn't mean it's right. It just means that it's not that wrong. It's only one step, but it's still in the wrong direction. So there's no, someone could say, "Well, I only drink one glass of wine." Well, fine, but that's one step in the wrong direction. And anyone who says that's not wrong is wrong themselves, because the truth of it is it's wrong. It's just wrong in a very small way. There's no magical line that you suddenly cross and you're drunk. Alcohol poisons the body and poisons the brain and causes the mind to be dulled and make it quite difficult to focus and to see things clearly. Even things like caffeine can do this, but alcohol doubly so. Now, as far as drugs, which are chemicals, certain drugs which have an effect on the chemical reactions that go on in the brain, well, again, these are simply a way of escaping unpleasant situations or striving after pleasant situations. It's still a compartmentalization of reality, trying to gain certain states. Some people say marijuana, for instance, can be used for medicinal purposes, and I suppose on a physical level, yes, it could, but I think you have to weigh that against the addiction element. And people always say that these things are not addictive, but psychologically, of course, they are, just like anything is. Any escape from reality is it's always an addiction, because we can't handle reality. We can't handle the ordinary state of existence, and it becomes less and less tolerable for us. So it's not a chemical addiction. Obviously, there's little or no chemical addiction with things like marijuana. But there's an emotional or a mental addiction to it, where we become addicted to the state. And this does work in the brain, that the brain starts to correspond the experiences and starts to seek after these experiences. But even more so in the mind, we're unable to take the sober state. It becomes less and less tolerable for us, and this is a compartmentalization of reality. Some experiences are then labeled as good, some are labeled as bad, and it gets worse and worse, and we're not able to be free from suffering as a result. We're always going to be subject to states of suffering because of our inability to deal with things as they are. So this, the five precepts, is the second part of what it means to be Buddhist, and if one keeps these two basic elementary practices or elementary groups of things that of I don't know what you would say that these two sets, if we can keep the refuges, if we can always take the Buddha as our guide and practice according to his teachings, practice the meditations as he taught them, and so on, and keep our morality, keep to these five precepts, then we could consider ourselves to be Buddhist. It's not like I'm trying to turn down any other practice or so on, though I myself don't subscribe to it. Other people might decide that they are better to follow other practices. This, in the understanding that I have it, is what it means to be Buddhist. And if one wishes to say that they are Buddhist, some people don't wish that. But if you wish, then these two qualifications have to be met. One has to take the three refuges and the five precepts. And so that's the talk that thought I would give today on how to be a Buddhist or what it means to be a Buddhist. I'd like to thank you all for tuning in, and hope to have you come back in the future. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them now via the chat box on the radio site. That's all for today. Thanks.